Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you could finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These 8 lectures are titled Business Law, Contracts. The lecturer is Professor Frank Cross of the College and Graduate School of Business at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Cross received his BA from the University of Kansas in 1977 and his JD from Harvard Law School in 1980. After graduation, he practiced law with the Washington, D.C. law firm of Kirkland & Ellis before his appointment at the University of Texas. While at the University of Texas, Professor Cross has taught undergraduate classes, MBA classes, and executive education courses in aspects of the legal environment of business. He has received numerous teaching awards, including departmental awards, MBA teaching awards, College of Business Administration awards, and one university-wide teaching award. Professor Cross also was honored 4 years ago as the nation's outstanding professor by the Academy of Legal Studies in Business and was recognized as a top teacher by the Business Week Guide to MBA Programs. Professor Cross has authored numerous publications, including over 30 articles in journals of law, science, policy, and management. He has also published 4 textbooks for business law classes and several other academic books. Professor Cross serves on the editorial boards of 4 journals, including the American Business Journal. Lecture 1, Foundations of Contract.
Greetings to Scipuli. Today, we're going to be embarking on a study of contracts and what makes a contract. And at the beginning, we're going to talk about the foundations of contract. So, what is a contract? You probably think you know one when you see one. That's many people's definition of contract, like of obscenity or something. But the truth is, you're probably wrong, because a contract is not necessarily what you think is a contract. Now, you think of a contract as what? Something that says whereof, herefore, theretofore, ipso facto, ipse dixit, all that, blah, 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 stuff you don't understand. And if it's got enough of that in there, and it's in writing, and the print is small enough, you think, well, that must be a contract. Looks like a contract. But it ain't necessarily so. The truth is, contract is a legal term defined by certain legal requirements. And in reality, the most cavalier, offhand comments could, in theory, sometimes make a contract. Every time you go into the grocery store and go shopping, you make a contract, and you don't have any elaborate language, and you may not say anything. Conversely, the most detailed, carefully written, constructed deal between two big businesses may in fact turn out not to be a contract, because there's some legal failing, something that was wrong in it. So a contract is not what you think it is. You don't necessarily know it when you see it. So what is it? Well, that's what we're going to talk about. Now, a contract rests on 2 very important core principles. The first is an agreement. The whole point of a contract is to have an agreement. That's the free market system. We get richer, we're better, we're more successful, we're happier if we can make voluntary agreements with people and, you know, I'll give you something that's valuable to you and you'll give me back something that's valuable to me. And it's got to be voluntary. That's the idea of an agreement, so a voluntary agreement. Now, not all voluntary agreements, though, are contracts. We could agree the Dallas Cowboys are going to win the Super Bowl. That's not a contract. No one's going to sue us if they don't. A contract also requires an exchange of something of value, an exchange of promises or of actions. A contract, by definition, has at least one promise, and usually 2, to do some sort of future act, and these promises are given in exchange for one another. That's what a contract is all about, a voluntary agreement to give a promise or an act in exchange for another. Now, you think of a contract, probably. You don't think of promises. You think of goods and services and money. But really, the contract is the promise to do those things. The contract is the promise to send you goods, and you promise to send me money. That's the contract. Then you fulfill it by fulfilling your promise. But the contract itself is usually the promise, although a promise may be an act. And they must be a deal. The promises must be a deal for one another, not given or gratuitous. Okay, well, there are generally considered to be four legal requirements for contract. These are agreement, consideration, capacity, and legality. Now, some say six, some say seven, but we'll work with these four. And I'm going to go into each of these four in somewhat more detail over the course of the next several lectures. But I want to give you an overview right now so you have some background, some understanding of where we're going. The first requirement of a contract is an agreement, which we break down in the law into an offer and an acceptance, which seems like a reasonable way to have an agreement. An offer and an acceptance. Now, I suspect you all have received an offer for some time. Some of you may have even accepted that offer. What's an offer? An offer would be, would you go bowling with me, Daisy May? That's the offer. And the acceptance is, of course, Bubba. There you have an offer and an acceptance. But it's not always, it doesn't have to be that simple. Sometimes you have counteroffers. Sometimes you may have, will you go bowling with me, Daisy May? And she doesn't say yes. She says, how about we go to a movie? That's called a counteroffer. Now she is the offeror. And now Bub is in the position of the offeree. And he could accept. He could say, sure, movie sounds good. Then they have a contract. But instead of him doing the offering, she did the offering. He did the accepting. Or he could make a counter-counteroffer. Say something about, well, what if we play video games at the bowling alley or something? But ultimately, you have to have an offer that you can define the terms of, and you have to have that accepted to have an agreement. Once you have an agreement, you're a long part of the way to having a contract, because that's fundamental to a contract. Now, a second requirement on contracts is what's called consideration. Now, you think you know what consideration means, right? Consideration means thoughtfulness, kindness. No. This is the law. Consideration means scratch, money. Law isn't concerned about thoughtfulness and kindness. We are concerned about money and things of tangible value. And consideration is something of tangible value that is given. Thus, I make a promise to send you some videotapes. Those videotapes have tangible value. That's consideration. You have a promise to send me in return some money. That's also got tangible value. And there you have an exchange of consideration. That's the sort of thing you need for a contract. Well, what if I just gave you some videotapes? Because I'm a nice guy. That wouldn't really be consideration because I'm not dealing to get anything back from you. It's a gift. It's nice. But that's not how you stay in business, by making people gifts. You have to have consideration going both ways in order to make yourself a contract. That's the second general requirement. The third general requirement is capacity. Now, the soul of contract is a voluntary exchange, of course. And for an exchange to be truly voluntary, if you think about it, the people making the exchange must have the capacity, the ability to engage in a contract. Well, who wouldn't? Well, your dog. I mean, you might try and make a contract with your dog. I mean, I suspect some of you probably have tried to make a contract with your dog. I mean, think about it. You say, Fido, if you don't get on the couch, I'll give you a dog bone. Now, that has all the attributes of a contract that we've seen so far, right? We're talking about an agreement here. You have an offer, and, you know, the dog woofs its acceptance or something. You have consideration. Right? He doesn't get on the couch. He's giving up something of value to him. And you're giving him a dog. Well, he's giving up something of value to you. But he jumps on the couch. Can you sue him? No. I'm sorry. A dog does not have the capacity to make a contract. And he can't sue him. Even if he happens to be really rich. You know, one of those dogs that some, you know, old person beloved and left their estate to. You still can't sue him. Because a dog does not have the capacity to make a contract. Now, dogs are not alone in this. Other minors, people underage, youths, juveniles, whatever, they're called minors in the law usually, don't have the capacity to make a contract. And they can pull some really fabulous scams that we'll talk about as a consequence. But a contract with a minor, you can't count on enforcing. And there are some other circumstances, of course. Someone who's extraordinarily intoxicated, somebody who is mentally incapacitated, permanently, temporarily, whatever reason, those people lack the capacity to contract. And those can't be good binding contracts either. Have a contract, you've got to have two people, both of whom have the capacity. Okay, and the fourth requirement of contract is legality. Legality. So, a contract's got to be legal. It's got to concern a legal subject matter, which is why you very seldom see, you know, the cases with titles like the Medellin cartel against the Cali cartel. Courts won't hear cases to enforce. Now, of course, contracts are so important that people in big drug deals, or all sorts of criminals have contracts. Sure they do. They've got to organize their business. But they can't go to court to enforce them. Which, I want to step back and think, why is it important to have a contract? What's the value of having a contract? Why is it better if we have a piece of paper that's a contract as opposed to a piece of paper that's a glerk or something? It's not a contract. Well, the importance of a contract and the importance of meeting these four requirements is that it is legally enforceable. That it is legally enforceable. That means if I have a contract with you and you don't send me the money, I can go to court and sue you and get my money. Do I want to do that? No, of course I don't want to do that. If I go to court, it's going to cost me a lot of money. I'm going to have to deal with a lot of nasty lawyer-type people. And it's going to take a lot of time. And then there's going to be the uncertainty. So I don't want to go to court. But I count on the fact that neither do you. Because if you don't pay me, you're going to have to go to court. You're going to have to spend some money. You're going to have to deal with your own nasty lawyer-type people. You're going to have to pay me, and you're also going to have to pay the lawyer. So it's a deterrent effect, in a way. The fact that we have a legally binding contract enables me to say, if you don't go along, I'm going to sue you. And you say to yourself, well, that's right, and I don't really want to be sued, so I better just go along. Now, when I talked about how the drug cartel people have contracts, but they can't be enforced in court. Well, why do they have contracts if they can't go to court to enforce them? Well, they have their own enforcement mechanisms. They don't really need courts to enforce theirs. But we, people who don't want to engage in violence, need courts to enforce our contracts, which is why we have to make sure they are contracts and they meet all of the requirements of the contract. Well, there are actually some interesting legality stories that are, you know, maybe of interest and benefit to you. The classic case here is from 1725. Now you're thinking, the professor's not teaching us the latest law. Well, that's true. The 1725 English case is not the latest law, but it's a good example of an illegal contract. There was a suit brought for an accounting on a partnership. Now, a suit brought for an accounting on a partnership is where one partner thinks the other partner is a crook and is cheating her. So how does she get her fair share of the partnership proceeds? Well, she may have to go to court. It's a contract. So you go to court and you ask for an accounting. And an accounting is where they lay out all the money, where all the money went, where all the money goes, and then you make sure you get your fair share. Well, this complaint, when you file a lawsuit, you usually file something called a complaint or a petition. This complaint said the partnership was a partnership that was very skilled in dealing with commodities. And they had recently dealt with a gentleman for a gold watch on the Heath at a very cheap rate. We wanted an accounting for those. Well, it became clear to the court eventually that this was a partnership of highwaymen, thieves, robbers. And I don't know whether you think there is or is not honor among thieves, but one of them didn't and brought this lawsuit. So when the court discovered that the people bringing the lawsuit were highwaymen, it dismissed the suit, it threw the lawyers in jail, and it hanged the parties. Now, today we do not have that sort of severe punishment for bringing suit on an illegal contract. And lawyers have made it very difficult to get themselves thrown in jail, as well as having their clients hanged. But, you know, that's an illustration of how courts won't enforce illegal contracts. Now, there is a more recent case which may seem of even possible relevance to you. This case is 1991. A fellow from New England, I think he lived in Massachusetts, liked to gamble. So he went down to Atlantic City to do some gambling. Well, I'm not too familiar with these things, but I guess they have these big machines where you get chips with which to gamble in Atlantic City. And how do you get chips? You just plug your credit card in that machine, and you, I suppose, punch in however many value chips you need, and the chips come pouring out, and then, you know, it's charged to your credit card. Right? So he gets his chips, he goes off and gambles. The court doesn't tell us whether he won or lost, but let's assume, in all probabilities, he lost. So he goes back to Massachusetts, and he gets his credit card bill. Now, the credit card was issued by a bank from Connecticut, and the credit card contract, remember contract, had a provision saying that any disputes about this contract will be resolved according to Connecticut law. Something else you'll learn, the law of contracts in various states differs a bit. So you want to know what state applies, and this Connecticut bank wanted its own law for its contracts. So it said any disputes will be resolved according to Connecticut law. Well, this fellow, this gambler, was clever or well-trained in the law or some such thing, because he discovered that under Connecticut law, gambling, at least this sort of Atlantic City gambling he was doing, was illegal. So he said, well, I don't think I really have to pay this part of my credit card bill because this is a contract for an illegal act. And you might be surprised, but the court agreed with him. Said, you win. You don't have to pay. That's called having your cake and eating it, too. This sort of thing doesn't happen very often. I mean, I don't want you to go out looking for opportunities to do this, because it's rare that that happens. But that just shows that we have this strong policy against contracts that are illegal. Now, we also have a policy for contracts that are contrary to public policy, even where no law exists. If a contract is so contrary to public policy, to the public interest, we'll invalidate it even if there's not a law against it. Well, that's the theory. This does not happen very often. We have a lot of laws in this country. I suspect you all are familiar with that. If there's a pretty strong public policy for something, I promise you, we've got a law on it. So this is pretty rare. It may still be used, though, in cases where modern technology runs ahead of the law. Now, the law can be sort of slow and awkward, and sometimes modern technology gets way ahead. So these reproductive technologies, these innovative reproductive technologies, I can't keep up with them. But, you know, if somebody wants to start a business where she gets pregnant in order to sell the eggs from her fetus to people who can't, I mean, a contract for a business like that probably would not be enforced, because it would be contrary to public policy, even if there's not a law against it. For all I know, there may be. But something really outlandishly contrary to public policy also will not be enforced. So those are our four main requirements for contract. Now the next bit of background is to look at types of contracts. Types of contracts. There are various different types of contracts. The first distinction in contracts that may be important is a unilateral contract versus a bilateral contract. What's the difference here? A bilateral contract is a promise for a promise. I promise to send you something, you promise to send me money. A unilateral contract, though, is a promise for an action. I don't want a promise, I want an act. I promise to send you something, you promise to have money in my hands on such and such a time and place. Now, suppose I want to have my lawn mowed for $20. I can go to a neighborhood guy and say, I promise to pay you $20 if you promise to mow my lawn. That's a bilateral contract. Or I can go to that neighborhood guy and say, I promise to pay you $20 if you mow my lawn. That's a unilateral contract. Well, it's the same deal, right? So what's the difference? What does it matter? Well, it matters because of the phrasing. The phrasing is how you tell the difference. Did I ask for a promise or did I ask for an action? And that phrasing, while it seems just like a formality or a technicality, has an actual real-world important consequence because it is the degree to which it is binding. If I make a bilateral contract to mow my lawn, we are both bound as of then and there. I have to pay him $20 if he mows my lawn, and he has to mow my lawn. He's promised to mow my lawn in order to get the $20. So if he doesn't mow my lawn, I can sue him. I mean, that would be kind of silly, suing someone for not mowing your lawn for $20, but I could. If it's a bilateral contract, he's promised and he's stuck. He's got to mow my lawn, even if he gets a better deal to mow somebody better's lawn. If it's a unilateral contract, though, he's not stuck. He doesn't have to mow my lawn. I just have to pay him $20 if he does. If he doesn't show up, if he decides, I'd rather go sailing today, doesn't mow my lawn, he hasn't broken any contract because he didn't promise to mow my lawn. So it can be important in the fact that it's binding. And if I make you a unilateral contract offer, this is all controlled by the person making the offer. I could offer you a bilateral contract, or I could offer you a unilateral contract. I could say, I promise to pay you $20 if you mow my lawn. And you say, well, I promised to mow your lawn. I say, no, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear your promises. I don't need any stinking promises. I want you to mow my lawn. You show up and mow my lawn, I'll pay you $20. So then if he shows up and mows my lawn, I have to pay him $20. If he doesn't show up, I can't do anything, right? So it doesn't seem like it's really very much in my interest to have a unilateral contract, except for one thing. I can revoke the unilateral contract until he performs. If I say, I make a contract with you of $20 to mow my lawn March 1st, if that's a bilateral contract, I'm stuck with that deal. I got to pay $20. He's got to mow the lawn on March 1st. What if it's a unilateral contract? Now, we know he doesn't have to show up on March 1st, but that also means I can revoke the contract on February 27th. I can find somebody who'll do it for $10. I can call him up and say, hey, forget it. I changed my mind. So you can revoke a unilateral contract. So a unilateral contract is far more flexible and not really much of a contract until you begin performance, which is why the vast majority of contracts out there, probably almost any contract you've signed, actually, was a bilateral contract. But it need not be. Some are unilateral, and they can have importance. Well, here's a classic case. Suppose I agreed to have some sort of contest, and I agree to pay somebody $10,000 if they swim from Alcatraz to the wharf in San Francisco. So this guy's a really good swimmer. He just jumps in, and he's swimming away, and he's doing great. You know, choppy waves and everything. He's going right through it, cutting right through it. And then he's swimming in, and he's now only 50 feet from the piers at San Francisco. And I'm standing out there at the piers, and I shout out, I revoke, right? Because supposedly he hasn't completed the act. I mean, the act was to swim all the way in. He hasn't done that. He's only swum 98% of the way in. Well, courts won't let you get away with that. I don't want to give you the impression from the gambling credit card case that courts always jump on technicalities. Courts developed it so that once he's begun performance, I can't revoke. And this comes up in some real cases, too, not involved swimming into Alcatraz. There's a recent case where a company employed a fellow to design a video game or electronic game of some sort, and he spent a lot of time working on it. And he was about 90% done with this, but they had done it as a unilateral contract. In other words, the company didn't want his promise. They wanted to see the game. So when he was about 90% done, the company fired him. But the company lost. You can't do that. You've got to give, once they've started the unilateral contract, you've got to give them a chance to finish. But the unilateral contract still has that flexibility. It lets you call it off before they've started. You know, if I can get to this guy before he leaves Alcatraz, then I can still call it off. Okay, that's unilateral or bilateral contract. Second category of contracts we're going to talk about is written contracts versus oral contracts. Written versus oral contracts. Well, some people think all contracts have to be in writing. Most people know there is such a thing as an oral contract, but they're not sure when it's legit. Most oral contracts are legit. The vast majority of contracts can be done orally. Kim Basinger found that out to her detriment. In these movie deals, apparently you have negotiations going back and forth between the studios and the agents all the time. And it's created a situation of fear called the creeping contract. That the closer those negotiations get to being specific, you may get to a point where there's a contract. Now, I understand that actors and actresses commonly get real close to deals and then back out because maybe they just got a better picture of, right? But when Kim Basinger agreed to do the movie Boxing Helena, I think, she had pretty much agreed, and she backed out after a time when the studio thought they had a contract. There was nothing in writing. They didn't have this written down. But they thought they had an oral contract for her to agree to do this movie. So they sued her, and she is $8.92 million poorer. I'm not sure how they got that measure of damages. Maybe because the movie would have done better if she were in it. I don't know. But that was an oral contract that had an enormous consequence. Now, I would recommend that you get your contract in writing, of course, if only because a contract in writing is much easier to prove if you have to sue on it, if you have to go into court. Now, the studio won vis-a-vis Kim Basinger without any writing by putting on the testimony of witnesses, and you can do that. Kim Basinger might have been advised to get it in writing that this was not a contract yet, or that we have no contract until it's in writing. I don't want to see any contract until it's in writing. She might have been better off. And there is sort of a presumption in the law that a big contract for something of great significance will be put in writing. But it depends on the circumstances. It doesn't have to be. There's a case we're going to talk about later, the Texaco Pennzoil case, which is another multi-billion dollar verdict this time, where it was a big case, a big takeover, and yet the court found that there was fundamentally an oral contract. So we have written contracts and you have oral contracts. And one last thing I want to point out on this distinction is that in the law, writing trumps oral. There's a rule in the law that I don't think we need to get into in great detail called the parole evidence rule. But this means that if you have a writing, that's your contract. And you don't want to rely on there being any little oral side deals. Because the law assumes that if you've got a contract in writing, that writing is the whole contract. If you've got an oral side deal, I advise you, put it in writing, because the court may just ignore it otherwise. You can have your whole contract oral. It's easier to have your whole contract be oral than just a part of it be oral, because if a part of it's oral, the court may ignore that. Figure you put everything in writing. Okay, now the next categorization of contracts is express contracts versus implied contracts. What's an express contract? It's not a really fast one. An express contract is one that's put into words. Well, you think, well, aren't all contracts put into words? No. You can have a contract without any words. This is a contract that is implied from the circumstances. You can have a contract without any words that's implied from the circumstances. Okay, suppose I walk into a barbershop. I probably need to. And what do? I walk up to the front desk, and there's this big chart up there that gives me the variety of shampoo or just cut or permanent, and you know, it's got prices, big chart up there with prices and things. I walk in and there's a perky young lady behind the front desk and says, "Hi, what's your name?" I say, "Well, my name's Frank Cross." And she says, "Well, very good. I'll put you in and have a seat over there." And I say, "Oh, okay." So I go and sit down and I familiarize myself with whatever events were current 2 years ago in their magazine selection. And I'm sitting there waiting, reading these old magazines. And then she calls me, "My name Frank." I say, "Yes." She said, "Come this way." Okay, so I go back there and say, "Sit down." I sit down. They shampoo me. "Come over here. Cut my hair." Then they present me with a bill, right, for whatever, 6, 8, 12 super hyper ultra cuts, whatever place it is. I say, "What's this?" I say, "Well, this is the bill for your haircut." I say, "Well, I didn't agree to pay for a haircut. I didn't say a word. Scarcely said a word since I came in here. There's no written contract. There's no oral contract. I didn't say anything. I don't see how you can expect me to pay for this haircut. I didn't make any contract or deal. I mean, I thought it was very nice that you were cutting my hair, but I didn't promise to pay." Well, a court would make me pay. A court would make me pay because it is implied from the circumstances that I have agreed to pay this money. When I walked in, I knew it was a barbershop. There were signs. I knew how much they expected me to pay. There was a sign. I voluntarily let them take me back there and cut my hair. So implied from my actions is my agreement to pay. So we had a contract, even if I had laryngitis and didn't say a single word. So implied contracts. These come up sometimes. Now, note, though, that an implied contract always requires an opportunity to reject it. You can't have an implied contract if the person has no opportunity to reject it. somebody comes over and paints my house, well, I didn't tell them to stop. I didn't even know they were there. I had no opportunity to reject it. So that's not an implied contract. On the other hand, if I'm sitting there and someone comes over and starts painting my house, I think there's an expectation that I would say, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? And if I let them go ahead and paint my house, there might be an implied contract. All right. Our next category on our line is voidable and unenforceable contracts. Now, a regular contract, a standard contract, is called a binding contract, which is a little bit redundant. We talked about the whole purpose of contracts is that they're binding. You can sue to enforce them. And likewise, a void contract is sort of oxymoronic. I mean, if it's not binding, it's not a contract. Well, but just for convenience, we use those words. A void contract is one that has no effect. It is illegal. That illegal contract with the credit card company has no effect. It's void. Get rid of it. Doesn't even count. Might as well not even exist. A voidable contract is a little bit different. It's also arguably not a real contract. A voidable contract is one where one of the parties can change her mind or change his mind and cancel and say, I don't like this contract. I'm backing out. And they can do it if it's a voidable contract. Well, that's a good thing to have, right? How do you get a voidable contract? Well, most contracts aren't. A voidable contract, though, as we'll talk about further, is one that a minor has. If a minor makes a contract, it is voidable at the option of the minor, the underage person. So that's a pretty good deal. And an unenforceable contract is a contract, these are words you hear sometimes, is a contract that is otherwise good, seems to have all the requirements of a contract, but for some reason cannot be enforced in court. And one example of that would be the statute of limitations. You all are probably familiar with the concept of a statute of limitations. That being, if you have a good case against someone, you have to bring it within 2 years or 4 years, or you can't bring it anymore. You can't wait decades to sue. Well, if you wait too long, you had a good contract, but now it's unenforceable, and you can't sue. But it still has a little bit of legal significance. We'll get to that under consideration. Okay, those are our types of contracts. Now you've got the basic requirements for contracts and the main types of contracts. I want to talk briefly about something called the Uniform Commercial Code. The Uniform Commercial Code. Contracts, you see, developed from common law. They grew out of English judge-made law. But in the United States, we decided we need a little bit of standardization here. So some super experts got together and drafted something called the Uniform Commercial Code, which is also called the UCC. And that UCC standardizes the law of contracts because it's been adopted by every state except Louisiana, my favorite. Louisiana, they do things their own way down there. And they haven't adopted the Uniform Commercial Code, but the other 49 have. And the Uniform Commercial Code creates some specific rules. At this point, just know it creates some specific rules. As we go through, we're going to talk about what some of them are. Now, the last main topic is contractual variance. Contractual variance. These things, they're not really contracts, but they're like contracts. They have the legal effect of a contract sometimes. And the first such contractual variant is the quasi-contract. Well, it sounds like a variant. A quasi-contract. This is a contract that is imposed by law. Remember I told you that the soul of contract was voluntary agreement? Well, I lied. Because sometimes the law will impose what is functionally a contract without any agreement because of fairness. The law will say because of fairness. But fairness alone isn't enough. It's also, the law requires a case that the parties would have made a contract if they could have. Parties would have made a contract if they could have. Okay, suppose I'm up here teaching, and some difficult students harass me to the point where I have a coronary. Okay, I'm in the midst of a heart attack. One of my good students in the front row sees her A slipping away if I die of a heart attack. So she has a real interest in saving me here, and she calls a doctor. Says, doctor, my professor's having a heart attack. Please come save him. Well, I said, well, okay, I could do that, but I don't know. He doesn't dress too well. Who's going to pay me if I save him? And he says, don't worry, I'll take care of it. Please save it. So the doctor comes down and administers CPR, some sort of life-giving therapy, and I recover, and I'm better, and I'm happy. And so semester's over, student gets an A, I'm happy. Sitting in my office, she comes by and says, remember when you had that heart attack in class? I said, yes, how could I forget? She says, well, I paid the doctor. I said, oh, how very nice of you. And she said, well, I was kind of thinking you're going to repay me. I say, oh, well, perhaps I should. Now, I don't remember the events very well. I don't remember if I made a contract back then. When I was lying down in the throes of my heart attack, did I say, yes, I agree to reimburse you? She said, no. You didn't say anything. You couldn't. I said, well, maybe we had an implied contract. Maybe I sort of waved the doctor. I sort of waved at you and said, okay. She said, no, you didn't do that. I said, well, hey, I'm a law professor. I know the law. If I didn't make an express contract and I didn't make an implied contract, we don't have a contract. Why should I pay you? Well, she would win because we had a quasi-contract. The law would impose a contract on me here to reimburse her because of fairness. But not just fairness, because the law assumes I would have made a contract if I could have, but I couldn't, so I didn't. In other words, when I had my heart attack, had I been able to respond to the offer, I will save you if you pay me, I would have said yes, right? So I don't get out of this contract simply because I was unable to respond to the offer. So that's a quasi-contract. Now, you have to be careful about using quasi-contracts because we are so concerned about voluntary agreement that we don't like to find quasi-contracts. You can't officiously go around forcing people into contracts. You know, suppose my neighbor contracts with someone to paint her house. Well, he gets a little confused, gets the address wrong. He paints my house instead. Well, he's done it. So what does he do? He comes up to me and says, well, I'd like to be paid for painting your house. I say, well, why should I pay? We didn't have a contract. He said, well, no, you didn't have a contract, but I read about this thing called quasi-contract. Seems to me like you've benefited from my painting your house. You've been unjustly enriched by having your previously tawdry house painted nicely. Given that, I think you really should pay me in quasi-contract. Well, what do you think? Do I say, no, of course not. I could have made a contract then. He could have come to me and made an agreement to paint my house. I would have had some choice in the color, too, right? But he didn't. So there's no quasi-contract there. The confused house painter, the case of the confused house painter loses. No contract. So quasi-contracts are limited, but sometimes happen. Okay, the next contractual variant is something called promissory estoppel. I think that's a real pretty name. Promissory estoppel. Has a nice rhyme to it. Now, this is where someone makes a promise to you, and you try to get the law to enforce that promise. Now, much of the point of contract law is that we don't enforce just promises. A promise has no consideration. A promise has no exchange. We don't enforce promises. They're nice. You should feel free to make them, but, you know, the law generally won't enforce them against you. However, there are some limited instances where the law will enforce a promise under the doctrine of promissory estoppel. And this is where you made your promise with the knowledge and expectation that it would induce reliance, justifiable reliance, on another party. That party relies, and then you break your promise. Then they can sue you to recover. In other words, suppose father goes to his son and says, son, I know you're working your way through college. I know it's tough. Quit that job of yours. I'll pay your way through college. So son says, hey, works for me. Quits his job. Says, dad, I quit my job. Now, where's tuition? Dad says, ha, I was just kidding. Get into the mill, boy. Get to work. Well, there was no contract there. The son never agreed to give the father something. But that would be a case of promissory estoppel, where the father made a promise in the expectation that the son would rely on that promise and do something, quit his job. Then when the son did so, the father refused to go through with the promise. The court may enforce that promise under the doctrine of promissory estoppel. There's a very, very famous case here called Hoffman against Red Owl Stores. We don't have time to get into all the facts and details, but Red Owl Stores, I've never been to a Red Owl store, but I understand they're big, they must be hot, they must be really happening stores in the north somewhere. Wisconsin was where this case arose, I think. This guy had mom and pop sort of grocery store. He wanted a Red Owl store. Darn it, that big Red Owl sign, I mean, that just draws people in. So he was negotiating with Red Owl to get a store. And Red Owl said, made some promises. Said, well, yeah, sure, you're a good businessman. We'll give you a store, but you've got to do some things. And these things involved selling his old store, which didn't have all the requirements of a Red Owl store, and investing in some new land and investing in equipment. So he did all that, jumped through all the hoops, and then they said, we changed our mind. Sorry, we're not going to give you a store. Well, that was found to be a case of promissory estoppel, where they made a promise to get him to take some actions in reliance on that promise, and they didn't follow through. So that's enforceable too, in promissory estoppel. That's another contractual variant. Okay, we don't have much time left, but I want to do a few review cases. Suppose you're a homeowner and you want to sell your house. This is a case that comes up fairly often. And you go to a real estate agent and you make a deal, a contract with that real estate agent, where if the agent provides a purchaser, that agent will get a commission of 6% or 8% or whatever. That's how these deals usually work. So you're having open houses, people are coming in, your agent's bringing in people, they're looking around saying, oh, lovely, all that. And you start changing your mind. You really don't think you want to sell. So just as you're about to change your mind, your agent produces somebody who has lots of money, real rich person, comes and says, I want to buy your house, I'm ready to buy your house. And the agent says, this is nice, because I get my commission. And you say, no, I don't think so. Change my mind, don't want to sell. So the agent says, what, you promised, please, my money. And you say, no, I don't want to sell. So the buyer walks away. The agent, though, thinks he still gets his commission. Should the agent get his commission? Well, in this case, the homeowner argued this was a unilateral contract. I'm paying him 8% for a purchaser. What is a purchaser? Well, you look up in the dictionary what a purchaser is, and it's someone who made a purchase. This guy, his rich buyer, didn't make any purchase. So there's no purchase. He didn't provide me a purchaser. He didn't purchase. So why should I owe the commission? Well, the law didn't buy that little technicality. The agent gets the commission. The law says the unilateral contract was to provide somebody who is willing and able and capable of purchasing the house, assuming the seller doesn't back out. So, but this shows that unilateral contracts can be tricky. That's the reason why most contracts are bilateral. Okay, how about this case? Two companies. One's called IL Industries, I think. The other one's Mitsubishi. I'm sure you've heard of it. Now, the deal they worked out here is for IL to buy Mitsubishi's forklift trucks. Mitsubishi makes certain forklift trucks. IL, gets them and sells them to American people in the American market. IL became a big, very successful dealer of these Mitsubishi trucks. And one way it did it is it made some changes. It made some adaptations to the U.S. market. It was allowed under the contract. IL could make, it was the retailer, but it could make these changes. And it made these changes, and they proved to be a big success. American purchasers loved them. So this is all working out fine, except then Mitsubishi says it doesn't want IL to sell its forklift trucks. I don't really know why. They had a falling out, a little spat at the management level, perhaps. So that's okay. They're allowed to do that under the contract. I mean, the contract had a termination clause. But IL does have something they want to sue for, because what Mitsubishi did was it took those modifications that IL was making to the forklifts in order to get them to sell better and used them for themselves. Mitsubishi said, well, hey, people want these modifications. There's no reason to make our retailers do it. We'll do it right here on our own level, right? And IL says, hey, you profited from our invention, from our creation, these modifications. So you owe us for that. Well, now that seems sort of fair in a way, but think about it. Why should Mitsubishi pay? Under what of our theories did they have a contract? No, they never had a contract. If IL had been smart, maybe, it would have got some sort of deal to be paid for those, you know, teaching Mitsubishi these valuable modifications. But it didn't. So, didn't have a contract. Does IL have any sort of argument? Well, they tried one, sure. They tried quasi-contract. They said, hey, you've been enriched. It's only fair that you should pay us for this great benefit that we've provided you. But if you were a court, what would you think to that argument? Well, you should think no. IL doesn't have a good claim in quasi-contract, because there's no reason they could not have made a contract. They could have made a contract. They didn't. It's their own fault. So, no quasi-contract. IL loses. They should have made a contract. It's one reason why it's important to know about contracts. We'll talk about some more in the next lectures.